The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre with your Corvallis City meetings for the week of March 18th, 2024. On Monday, March 18th, the Corvallis City Council will be holding an executive session at 5 p.m. to discuss the status of pending litigation or litigation likely to be filed. Also on Monday, March 18th, but at 6 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a meeting. The meeting will be held in person at the downtown fire station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. See CorvallisOregon.gov for agenda details and information on how to attend the meeting online. On Tuesday, March 19th at 5 p.m., the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force will be meeting virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting online. On Wednesday, March 20th, the Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Advisory Board will meet virtually at 5 p.m. For details on how to join the meeting, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Thursday, March 21st at 4 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a joint work session with the Budget Commission. The meeting will be held virtually and in person at the downtown fire station, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
You're listening to KORC. I'm Nick Martin. Since Speaker of the Oregon House Dan Rayfield has announced his run for Oregon Attorney General, the district that represents Corvallis and Adair Village is up for grabs. Two candidates are currently vying for that seat. Corvallis School Board member and OSU engineering instructor Sammy L. Abdraba is making a second run at the position. Academic advisor and also a member of the Corvallis School Board, Sarah Finger McDonald, is also running for the seat. I interviewed Sarah the second week of February, which he broadcasted here on KORC News, Music, and Civics, and in order for both candidates to have a fair and equal opportunity to time on our airwaves, I asked Sammy if he'd like to speak with me as well, to which he agreed. As mentioned above, Sammy works as an engineering instructor at Oregon State University and does contracting work with HP. He also serves on the Corvallis School Board, where he served as chair from 2019 to 2022, when he stepped down to focus on his campaign for Oregon's 4th Congressional District. Sammy and I sat down at the bustling New Morning Bakery last week to talk about his life and campaign. Here it is.
Hey, do you mind introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, my name is Sammy L. Abdraba. And I am an engineer by profession. I manage projects locally here with the tech industry where we install technology. I teach at the university, and most of my time actually is fulfilled by public service, connecting people with solutions, understanding problems that they're facing. So my background, I'm a troublemaker, a good kind of trouble when the status quo is not working. I advocate for better things and better solutions. So, for example, when we heard that there's lead in the water in different parts of the country, and the school district wanted to investigate to the extent which water faucets has them and water fountains has them, I jumped in to volunteer for the budget committee for the school district, served on the school board since 2017, right now I serve on the national and statewide and local boards of education and associations that supports education. And my background is how can we make things better.
What made you decide to run for District 16, and what have you learned since the last time you ran for this seat?
Yeah, so I learned a lot. I learned that it takes building coalitions, working for years on making sure people understand what you stand for, who you are, and where you come from. And also making sure that you help and support the community, not necessarily when you're running for office or only when you're not running for office all the time. That's what I've been doing for a while. And right now with Dan Rayfield going from representing our district to running for Attorney General, and I wish him best of luck in that run. I want to thank him for the work and continue the important work that the legislator is doing. I feel there's so much need for affordable housing, workforce housing in our community. I want to make sure that whether renters or first home buyers and middle class can afford to find housing, and for those who are struggling to find shelter, to find compassionate solutions that support them with sheltering, support folks dealing with drug addictions in a compassionate and assertive way, and making sure our students and the ones who take care of them are taken care of. And I believe there is so much work to be done there, and I bring the expertise that I have done over the past decade in public service. So my why, I don't want to give up on the opportunity to make things better for the next generation. That's how my grandmother did not give up on me when she took me under her care 3 months before I can go to a public school, speaking a language of English language, not the language of my ancestors. And she was like, we need to fix this. So she taught me Arabic. I was able to thrive in public schools. I went through bullying, and my father advocated for me and made sure the school system is safer, a little bit safer than it how it was. And then I started self-advocating for myself. I am running to make sure we all can have a voice in decision making. And I know we cannot do it on the local level only. We need to do it on the local level. We need to do it on the state level. Well, we have a huge shortfall in what we need to do in our schools. And we need someone who really understand what our teachers and classified staff in schools deserve, what our population here in the community deserve in terms of mental health supports, physical health supports, access to health care. All of these things really fire me up every morning, and I want to serve because of that.
Hmm. I want to expand on that. So how will your experience on the Corvallis School Board prepare you to address those issues that you just talked about?
Yeah, so, you know, as a school board, locally, we are quasi-judicial. We have to adjudicate things judiciously. We are a board that develops and approves policy. We also approve budget. And the most important part that's relevant as well is we advocate for policies. So when things, and legislation, when things don't work for us, we communicate with the community and we share with the community what we are learning, and we learn from the community what are the needs. And that's why I believe someone who serves on the school board gives them a good lens on the three branches of government, so to speak. Even though our quasi-judicial is not fully judicial, we have to be judicious. Our policies are within the laws of the state and the nation, but still we need to develop rules. And budgetary, we take care of hundreds of millions of dollars, and we allocate them according to the values of our community. All of that's informed me, but that's not enough. You need to have someone who actually served on a national level and state level who can have that advantage. So in 2025, in the legislative session, we're going to see a huge, huge package for education funding. And you can't do that unless you have negotiated budgets on a state level before, unless you know what's the national climate around education. And these are some of the unique public service opportunities that I had that gives me an advantage, and also, honestly, not only within the school district or the house district, but across Oregon, we are going to lose an important leader in the House who understood the budget, who understood how to navigate the process. And Speaker Rayfield have done phenomenal work, and you need someone who really understand how to negotiate that. So one example of my experience is when the legislature proposed $9.5 billion, when you divide that over 197 school districts, that's really was considered a cut budget, even though it's on a numerical value is more than before, but it does not accommodate the current service level. It does not accommodate how much the gas is costing us. It used to cost us like 40% extra last biennium. Our teachers and classified staff were asking way more than 2.5% that was assumed by the legislature. So I navigated the process with the legislatures and also advocated here alongside with the president of the union who endorsed me, Krista Schmieder, and also with Therese Jones, who also exclusively endorsed me in this race. And the three of us started collecting signatures. Printed cards, collected signatures, children collected signatures, teachers, parents collected signatures over a weekend. And actually, one of the days on that weekend, a child stopped me and was like, would you sign this card? It was very fulfilling to see that our community is advocating. Those cards went into Speaker Rayfield's office, and we had a discussion, an honest discussion about really the complex nature of the state's budgets and how we need to balance different issues. But there was an acknowledgement that 9.5 is not enough, and we went to 10.2. 10.2 still is not enough because you have seen how Portland Public Schools have ended up in a strike and how we're seeing an impasse in Salem-Keizer School District. And we're going to see that in a couple of other more school districts in the near future. I worry about that. And that cannot be solved unless you have someone who really can advocate bottom-up and with legislators across the House and the Senate to make sure we can prioritize our values, taking care for the children, the seniors, and everybody in between. Mm.
Okay, switching gears a little bit. You mentioned the housing crisis and houselessness, and addressing the houselessness crisis is on your list of priorities. Specifically, it says, addressing the crisis requires an all-of-the-above strategy to expand humane alternatives to get help to help people off the streets. Can you expand on what specifically you will do to address houselessness?
Absolutely. You know, we need to make sure people who need the help receive the help when they need it, as soon as they need it, as soon as possible. That collaboration have to be done alongside our nonprofits, providers, and county, city, and the state legislature, understanding the nuances and the differences between what Corvallis needs, what the metro area need to solve homelessness, what's going on east of the Cascades and also on the coast. So that's the number one approach that I want to be very mindful of. When you have someone who is running for the state legislature, they are going to be representing a district and serving the whole state. And a top-down approach will never work for a problem that is universal but also unique in its approaches. So micro-sheltering could be a really great example of how it works for Sweet Home. I want to encourage projects like Turnkey. It's been very successful here on 3rd Street for Housing First and other projects like that. So we want to make sure we're capturing how effective they are, and also we support more developments like that. So that's number one. Number two, you know, I teach hundreds of students a year system dynamics, and I tell them, think about any problem as a bathtub, and the water is either something good or bad that's filling up and accumulating. And for this bathtub, it's a system. Think of homelessness as like a system. There's incoming and there's outgoing flow from that problem. Right now, to solve this problem, you need to treat it from both sides. Number one, if someone is one paycheck away from being homeless, we must invest in solutions that prevent them from ending up being homeless and costing the state much more money, but also having huge emotional and physical toll on them. So that's one of the things we've done in the school district, and I want to give our school district staff a kudos to that work through the McKinney-Vento program, where they have advocated to support with rent assistance for the families who are on the edge of going homeless. That's been phenomenal. It should mean that burden should not be on the state, on the districts. It should be on the state. The state should really support those programs and ensure that we're navigating that with people who are experiencing it, have a way for us to really help people with rent assistance if they're going through an emergency or a crisis where truly 1 month of rent worth of security could actually save them from going homeless. Now on the other side, how you can bring people out of the streets to shelters, that's going to be a complex, all the above solutions. We're talking about mental health supports, social services, drug addiction supports, and frankly, rehabilitation for those who have been in the criminal justice system and they're out of it and now they're struggling to go back on their feet. What kind of support you can help them with to get there? So those are the specific approaches. Now, policies that are going to be effective is going to take a village, not one representative. And that's what I'm really looking forward on those conversations I'm having right now with the community.
You have a background in engineering, as you have you said, and you said you teach it?
Yeah.
To OSU? I read you worked at General Electric, correct?
I did way back then, more than a decade, yes.
Okay, and you do you still currently work at Hewlett-Packard?
I work with them, so I have consulting work with them, and I manage the installation of their page-wide presses. So I go all across the nation, also some other countries in the Americas continents, where we install page-wide presses. That is phenomenal technology from Corvallis and manufactured across the globe, actually, and designed where you can print 1,000 feet per minute books, and they have really good quality where the water-based ink is sustainable, is less harmful to the environment than the traditional ink. So that's part of my main source of income.
And it seems when you gave that example of the bathtub that you approach things with that mindset of an engineer. And how will that experience at GE and HP and your experience teaching engineering and your degrees in engineering, how will that help you in the State House?
Yeah, first of all, I have to recognize the stereotype about engineers, we don't like to talk to people, is not true. So that's number one, making sure I break that stereotype. And I believe I'm working on it still. I think it's really fulfilling that knocking, my vision is to knock 10,000 doors in this election, and I'm on track to go there. To really listen, that's what any engineer needs to do as the first step. You need to listen to their requirements of the solution before you start building the solution. Whether politicians or engineers or any kind of human being, our impulse to solve the problem sometimes supersede our need to have the humility to listen and understand deeply the problem first. So I think that's one of the things that I am disciplined with, and I've done it day in, day out as a profession or as a policymaker, is understand the problem and make sure you verify the requirements of what a solution for the problem should achieve before you think about what kind of solution we should have. So the legislator actually sometimes follows that process. Before they provide a bill to fix something, they have a committee or a task force that investigates it. Now, my approach is when you do that, you need to have people who are represented by the community that's impacted. So if you want to solve homelessness and houselessness, you want to support it with people who can speak for themselves from the community, providers who are helping them out, and people who are maybe on the edge of maybe going there. So really, that's my approach first and foremost that I have learned as an engineer. Now, another thing that engineers do is we have the humility to understand one solution or the first solution that comes to mind probably is not the best solution. And we need to actually verify that. Also, as someone who started a business in the past, I have the expertise that paralysis by analysis is a problem that scientists, engineers, policymakers, human beings in general may end up doing, and it may actually hurt. Sometimes you need to analyze, but don't let that slow you down from moving forward. So we need to do our due diligence to understand the problem, and also we need to understand what's our timeline to start tackling the problem, because Oregonians cannot wait for an extra year, two or five, to properly pay our educators and fully support our public school system. Oregonians cannot wait for the houselessness crisis to be fully investigated. We do know some critical issues and problems that we can solve, and I really look forward to work alongside with my colleagues on the community to have immediate solutions, but also a long-term view of how those solutions are going to help us long term.
Now, another one of your priorities is defending our civil rights. On your campaign website, it says you fought to protect every person's right to vote and protest. What did that fight look like?
Yeah, you know, when I was in Bahrain, I saw the Arab Spring in Bahrain, and where people's voice was suppressed, not only through the democratic process that was not completely accessible, but by acts of violence and by attentions that really dismantled the trust in governments. And I'm seeing it right here. So when the former president, a former president, had declared that I don't belong and people like me need to be out of this country until we figure things out, I protested and I paid attention to policies that we can protest, including the so-called Muslim ban that has impacted Middle Easterns from different backgrounds and faiths. I did also advocate with organizations like Next Up to expand access to voting for folks who are 16 and above in city council and school boards. We still did not get there. I really hope we can get there soon. I continue to struggle to push for better access for people who have experienced domestic violence situations in the past, and now they're fearful that their participation in the process, whether by running for office or even voting and registering to vote, could expose them. And there are some vulnerabilities in the system that may expose them to their abusers or past abusers who these are really immediate things. I really hope we can treat them as soon as possible. The first time I fought for our civil rights, I did not know it was that. I thought I'm a troublemaker. I lived in Saudi Arabia from age of 5 or 6 all the way until I graduated from undergrad. And I was in a public school there where you're asked to pray in a certain way. And if you pray in a different way, you're considered violating the rules. Even though they're all under the same umbrella. So for multiple times, including one time I did not put my hands on my chest, so I put them on the side of my, like that was the kind of a symbol of protest that I made. And the assistant principal asked me to stand in front of everybody and raise my hand and receive 10 lashes. That was the same penalty that you receive as a troublemaker, the same penalty that you receive if you say something wrong or if you, you know, if you're violating the rules. Now, number one, there was no rule that's prohibited us from praying the way that under this, like that was not in the rules. What's even more serious, corporal punishment was actually not on the books. It was prohibited on the books. Nevertheless, it was practiced. So I still remember it like it's yesterday. He asked me to raise my hand, and I told him, why should I raise my hand if I don't believe that's what you're doing is right, and I don't believe I did anything wrong? So he gave me a strong whip at my buttocks. I don't know if that's kosher to say on the air. And he told me, don't do it again. I was like, well, you bet I will. And that was not it. I was banned from public speaking because I did not say the things according to the interpretations of a certain school of thought. I did not say anything wrong. I just used different sources. I was a troublemaker, pushing the boundaries. When the laws and policies are not implemented or the laws and policies are not fair, that experience is not a foreign experience. That experience existed in the United States. Our rules and laws have not been developed with all Oregonians in mind. Our rules and laws are not implemented in a fair way. That's why Pepun, who supports farm workers, especially Latino farm workers in Oregon, have endorsed me exclusively. They're fighting for farmers to be safe from pesticides. They're fighting for farmers to be safe from wage thefts. They're fighting for their children to have access to SNAP benefits, even if they're not documented. That's the fights I'm fighting every day, and I really look forward to doing it in the legislature.
Yeah, thank you for that story. What are your plans for engaging with constituents with opposing viewpoints?
Listen, just like we're across the same table here, listen, make sure they have a very crucial opportunity to make their voice heard, and also understand that, you know, one time there was a reporter who would report in the city council like there was 20 opposed and 100 in favor and 2 neutral, which is important. You need to have the tally, but you need to go beyond the tally, which is for opposing views, where you're coming from. Am I missing something in my blind spots in terms of your lived experience, in terms of what you bring to the table? And I need to bring that in to understanding the problem, understanding the solution, but also facilitates a conversation. Opposing views comes most of the time from disagreement on issues, how we solve them, rather than values. If there are disagreements on values, we need to be clear about our disagreements on values. For example, in the Democratic primary, probably you'll have very few, if any, disagreements on values. So then you go into opposing views on how we approach it. And let's make sure people who are impacted by the problem have a stronger voice than people who are not impacted by the problem. So that's my lens, an equity lens that elevates the voices that are less likely to be heard, empower those who are impacted by the problem more, and make sure in this democracy it is 365, 24/7. Literally, I tell people, call me at 3 a.m. if there's a problem that you want me to be aware of. And I did get one call at 3 a.m. in one of the election cycles, and I'm grateful for it. I would say this is something you have to do as an elected official all year around, not only when you're running for office. And I've been proven that, not only through social media or having my phone accessible to constituents, but by proactively being at places where decisions are made, and also being at places where people are talking about the problem or experiencing the problem. That's why I've been engaging with different sides of different conversations, making sure people see each other eye to eye in addressing the problems. And nevertheless, I'm going to be fighting tooth and nail for my values. If someone disagrees with women's right to access reproductive health, or people in general access to reproductive health, then if someone does not see the humanity of all people from all gender identities, their opposing views are despicable, and I will fight that. And I will say thank you very much for what you're saying. Please see the humanity in the other side. If someone will, I'm going to get rallied up here. If someone thinks that Nazi ideology is an opposing of a point of view that deserves attention, they are mistaken. And let me make this very clear. I will every day, and whether in a primary or general election or service, fight those who think that we don't belong. And by we, I mean every woman, trans person, Muslim, Latina, Arabi, Jewish, Christian, whatever your background is, you belong. And if someone has an opposing view that actually questions that, those people need to really rethink if this nation is representative of their values, because it's not. We're building a nation for all people, for each one of us. That's an opposing view I cannot tolerate a single second.
Should you be elected and work at the State House, you will be working with fellow representatives who may have conflicting viewpoints. I guess, how will you work with those representatives who may not agree with you?
Same deal. Same way you do it with a constituents. And even more important, representatives come from different parties, different walks of life, and different perspectives, and also different constituencies. And I will have to make a decision for Oregon on behalf of my district, meaning sometimes I actually need to be humble and listen to where people are coming from. With the same breath, like there's a representative from the other side of the aisle who think that non-Christians, whether atheists or Muslims, should not be qualified for office. For someone like that, I really worry about, like, how does this person, it's very sad. Like, we do have currently a Muslim state senator, and I look forward to represent Corvallis with all backgrounds. So for someone to have that kind of opposing view, I really ask for their constituents to hold them accountable. But for someone who will have opposing view in terms of how we can build the legislation, we need to have an honest conversation where we're coming from and how our legislative concepts are different, and find a compromise and make sure we pass something with a majority. And when the majority rules, the minority's voice will be heard and everybody will show up to work. And that's what I expect from them. I expect them to show up to work, have the conversation, and then support the decision of the majority.
All right. Well, do you have any concluding remarks?
Yeah, I want to thank everybody listening to this. My name is Sami Alav Drabo. You can go to samioregon.com, samioregon.com, to learn more. I'm really privileged and honored to have the strongest support in my community in the race I'm in, not only from community members, community leaders, exclusively the chair of the school board, and every single board member except my opponents, of course, and also unions supporting me from the building trades, from the largest union that represents workers and grocery stores, the UFCW 555. That support means a lot to me. I'm privileged to be out of the labor movement, serving people from that experience, and coming out of that gives you huge humility that I will not be able to do it alone. I really need your help. If you're listening, have a conversation with someone else who may never, he may have not thought about this race yet. Get them engaged and involved, and chip in if you can.
All right. Thanks for talking with me, Sami.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That was Sami Alabdraba, one of the candidates running for representative of District 16, the state district that covers Corvallis and Adair Village. The Democratic primaries will be held this May, while the general election will occur in November. This is Nick Martin with KORC.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Krall. As part of KORC's commitment to equal time for candidates, Nick Martin also interviewed Sarah Finger McDonald on this program back in February. On Saturday, March 9th, there was a fatal shooting in Corvallis on Northwest Highland Drive. 34-year-old Vanetta Johnson was murdered by her boyfriend, 53-year-old Jerry Bruce Mitchell Sr. of Long Beach, California, who also shot and injured Vanetta's sister, a 24-year-old resident of Eugene. Mitchell fled, but was tracked using several technologies which tracked him traveling south near Medford later that Saturday night. The California Highway Patrol found and arrested Mitchell following a 45-minute pursuit that exceeded 100 miles per hour at times, according to the release, and Mitchell was apprehended shortly after midnight. He was booked at the Siskiyou County Jail and was arraigned in the Benton County Court on this past Friday. Mitchell pleaded not guilty to charges of first-degree murder and attempted murder, unlawful weapon use, and felon in possession of a firearm. In court documents, Corvallis police allege the Saturday, March 9th shooting resulted from domestic violence and took place while the victim's children were at home. The family released statements showing their heartbreak over the matter and requested that Mitchell not be released. A Corvallis man took his own life publicly this past Tuesday. Corvallis police responded to a self-inflicted gunshot wound around 9:46 a.m. Tuesday morning in the College Hill West Historic District at Northwest 28th Street and Van Buren Avenue. The death occurred outside a residence. The next day, the person was identified as 81-year-old William Gilbert of Corvallis, a former oceanographic data processor at Oregon State University. If you are considering suicide or know someone who is, Oregon's mental health hotline is 988. A local prominent businessman with an extensive criminal history has been charged with second-degree sexual abuse and providing liquor to a person under 21 years of age. Joel Dahl is the head of Dahled Up Construction, an Albany-based business with a crucifix in its logo and the use of a computer-animated character with an ominous hollow stare and a dubious smile. The company sign was covered with temporary "Under New Ownership" signage following the criminal allegations against Joel Dahl. His daughter was the one who called police. She said he was seen cuddling with the underaged victim and undressed late Saturday night at Joel Dahl's home in Albany. Dahl, his daughter, the victim, and another person reportedly had taken a trip to the coast that afternoon, a trip where supplies included plenty of alcohol. Joel Dahl was said to be drinking as well, and it was not clear who was driving. The victim later told police she was intoxicated when they returned to Dahl's residence. When they got back to Dahl's house, the victim went to his bedroom to share a cigarette, according to the police affidavit, which states Dahl's daughter later saw them lying together on the floor, undressed. The daughter and another unnamed person then left Dahl's house and returned later to get the victim. Dahl told them he did not know where the victim was, but then she was found hiding in a closet and came out stumbling. The other person present later corroborated this story in a police interview. Police contacted the victim, who initially declined to discuss what had happened. On March 11th, the victim was interviewed at the Albany Police Department. According to the affidavit, she alleged Dahl touched her intimately, and while she did not tell him no, she also did not consent to the intimacy. She reported feeling as though she could not say anything, according to the police affidavit. The victim said during the incident, Dahl's daughter opened the door of the room they were in, and the victim gave her a look as if to say, "Save me." Sometime after midnight, when Dahl's daughter and the other person came back for the victim, Dahl allegedly told the victim to hide, and if his daughter questioned anything, she was to just say she's trippin', according to the affidavit. Dahl knew the victim was not yet 18 years old. According to the police affidavit, he had offered to pay for a tattoo on her 18th birthday. Following his arrest, Dahl was released on $1,500 of a $15,000 bail, according to court records. Joel Dahl has criminal convictions dating back to 1996, including convictions for conspiracy to commit a felony, assault, driving under the influence, criminal mischief, theft, fleeing police, harassment, identity theft, possession of methamphetamine, resisting arrest, and escape. Back in 2018, Dahled Up Construction made national headlines when a former employee alleged he was fired for refusing to join a Christian Bible study group in order to keep his job. Ryan Coleman sued Dahled Up Construction for $800,000 in a civil lawsuit that ultimately was dismissed instead of going to trial. A special thanks to the Corvallis Gazette-Times for information provided in these stories. Their website is gazettetimes.com. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Krall.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. This week, we're featuring segments from Democracy Now! From the week of March 11, 2024. You'll hear information about the Israel-Gaza war, a migrant boat sinking off the coast of Libya, updates about the parents of a shooter at a Michigan school who were tried for involuntary manslaughter, and Bernie Sanders' proposed legislation for a four-day work week, as well as other stories and music. For more information, visit democracynow.org.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Right now in our country, we are facing a very serious health crisis. In states around our country, extremists have proposed and passed laws that have denied women access to reproductive health care.
Vice President Kamala Harris visits Planned Parenthood Clinic in St. Paul, believed to be the first time a president or vice president has publicly toured an abortion clinic. We'll go to Minnesota to speak with the head of a reproductive rights group there. Then students at Hebrew University in Jerusalem protest the suspension of a Palestinian professor. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli forces killed at least 29 people in Gaza on Thursday in two separate attacks as they waited for humanitarian aid. The latest massacre struck Palestinians in northern Gaza City and at the Al-Nusrat camp in central Gaza. Even before yesterday's massacre, Gazan officials reported Israeli forces have killed more than 400 Palestinians as they wait for aid deliveries. Hamas has reportedly proposed a ceasefire deal, which includes the release of hostages in exchange for 700 to 1,000 Palestinian prisoners, delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza, and the return of forcibly displaced Palestinians to their homes. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer offered his most scathing condemnation of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his far-right government, calling for new elections in Israel. He spoke from the Senate floor.
If Prime Minister Netanyahu's current coalition remains in power after the war begins to wind down and continues to pursue dangerous and inflammatory policies that test existing U.S. standards for assistance, then the United States will have no choice but to play a more active role in shaping Israeli policy by using our leverage to change.
Meanwhile, the Biden administration imposed sanctions on two Israeli settler outposts and three individual settlers in the occupied West Bank who have harassed and attacked Palestinians. In South Africa, Naledi Pandor, Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, warned South African citizens they will face prosecution if they serve in the Israeli military as it commits war crimes in Gaza. Pandor said, "When you come home, we're going to arrest you." At least 60 people, including children, are feared dead in the Mediterranean Sea after departing Libya on a migrant vessel that went adrift en route to Europe. The engine reportedly broke down, leaving the group lost at sea for days without food and water. Several others were rescued, many of them from Senegal, Mali, and Gambia. The humanitarian aid group SOS Méditerranée said it had rescued another 200 migrants headed to Europe on a wooden boat in an overcrowded rubber dinghy. According to the International Organization for Migration, 2,500 migrants died or went missing in the Mediterranean last year as they attempted to reach Europe. 200 deaths have been recorded since the start of this year. In Washington state, the immigrant rights group La Resistencia is reporting over 300 people have joined a hunger strike following the recent death of Charles Leo Daniel, a 61-year-old man from Trinidad and Tobago, and reports of several suicide attempts at the troubled Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma. Activists have set up an encampment outside the jail as they and detained immigrants participate in the peaceful action, demanding Northwest be shut down. They're also calling for an independent investigation into Daniel's death, who was found unresponsive while being held in solitary confinement earlier this month. Northwest is run by the private company Geo Group. To see our recent interview with La Resistencia's Marumoro Pidelpando, who's herself on hunger strike, go to democracynow.org. In Michigan, a jury found James Crumbly guilty of involuntary manslaughter for failing to prevent his teenage son from going on a shooting spree, which killed four students at Oxford High in 2021. James Crumbly's wife, Jennifer, was convicted on the same charges last month after prosecutors successfully argued the couple ignored obvious warning signs and bought the gun for their son. It's the first time parents have been directly charged for deaths caused by their child in a mass shooting. They'll both be sentenced next month. In California, authorities have released body cam footage showing the moments before deputies shot and killed 15-year-old Ryan Gaynor, a black child with autism, holding a gardening tool at the time. Video of the second deputy to arrive shows just 8.5 seconds passed from when he exited his vehicle to when he shot the teen. Distraught family members can be heard asking, "Why did you shoot my baby? And where is your taser?" The family's lawyer said at least two of the officers on the scene were familiar with Ryan Gaynor and would have known he did not pose a threat. And Senator Bernie Sanders has introduced legislation calling for a 32-hour work week. Sanders said the proposal is not a radical idea and has countries and companies around the world increasingly adopt shorter work weeks and record the same or, in many cases, higher rates of productivity. Sanders said technological advances have benefited corporations and CEOs while leaving out workers and that AI threatens to further deepen this inequality. On Thursday, a Senate panel held a hearing on the issue. This is UAW President Sean Fain, who pushed for a 32-hour work week in his union's initial contract demands to the big three automakers last fall.
But time, just like every precious resource in our society, is not freely given to the working class. Since the Industrial Revolution, we've seen productivity in our society skyrocket. With the advance of technology, one worker is now doing what 12 workers used to do. More profit is being squeezed out of every hour, every minute, and every second. Who's going to act to fix this epidemic of lives dominated by work? Are the employers going to act? Will Congress act? You know, how can working class peoples take back their lives and take back their time?
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
I get along with anyone, but when I'm cold, I'm on the outside, the greatest inside joke. And I hate all my clothes, feels like my skin doesn't fit right over my bones. So I guess I should go, the party's done and I'm no fun. Searching how to start a conversation on a website. I talked to the top guy, swore I was his type. Guess that he was making out with boys at the park. Everything I do is tragic. Every guy I like is gay. The morning after I panic.
Ballad of a Homeschool Girl by Olivia Rodrigo, who last month launched the Fund for Good campaign to support reproductive health freedom. This week, Rodrigo collaborated with reproductive rights groups to hand out free emergency contraceptives, abortion access resources, and contraceptives at her show in St. Louis, Missouri. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Over 100 leading European academics have signed a petition condemning what they call Israel's systemic annihilation, unquote, of the educational system in the Gaza Strip. The petition, which was led by the group Euromed Human Rights Monitor, condemns Israel's targeting of academics, educational institutions, and cultural heritage sites in Gaza. As The Intercept recently reported, within the first 100 days of its war on Gaza, the Israeli military systematically destroyed every single university in the Gaza Strip. Nearly 100 university deans and professors and 3 university presidents in Gaza have been killed in the Israeli assault.
Can't get the image out of my heart when we've seen the bodies found in a mountain of parts. Netanyahu told you just another child of the dark. Clear it's gonna take much more than thousands to march, more than a speech, more than a poem, more than a track of music. Gonna take more than a sit down with Bassem Youssef. Even bringing back ambassadors is an act that's useless, long as you pump oil for Apaches and the tanks they're using. Freedom just beyond reach for people you cannot see. He's wheezing and cannot breathe and screaming through the concrete.
Palestine will never die by Lokeith. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
For more information on the stories you just heard, as well as other national and international news, visit democracynow.org. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics.
You're listening to KORC. This is listener-supported community radio in Corvallis. This is Dan Krall in the Southtown studio, and I am joined today by A.V. Meadows of a collective of artists. Their acronym is NOST, N-O-S-T. What does that stand for?
Hey, Dan, thanks for asking. NOST stands for Northside Open Studios Tour. We're having our second annual appearance this coming April 20th and 21st in North Corvallis.
So what is NOST or N-O-S-T? From what I understand, it's artists opening up their home and showing off their art.
Well, one of the biggest things we want to relay to the community is that we believe that we can create the sort of world and community that we want to live in. And we think the best way to do that is through opening up our homes and talking about our art and process.
I did not have a chance to go on this last year, but I remember hearing about it. How did last year's event go?
It exceeded our expectations. We were expecting, you know, wouldn't it be great if we had about 40 or 50 people to come through? And we stopped counting at 200 people coming through my studio alone. And all the participating studios last year had that amount of numbers of people.
And that this event is coming up on Saturday, April 20th, and Sunday, April 21st.
Yeah, this year we went up to 2 days rather than one, and it's April 20th and 21st with 16 local Corvallis artists and over 20 youth artists participating this year as well. And it will be from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on both days.
Super cool. Now, I understand you have a website. Does this website have a map of all the houses that will be on this tour?
We will have an updated map, yes. We have a website, and our website is www.nost-art.com.
What kind of art do you do?
Thanks for asking. I am a ceramic artist, and I make whimsical, lovable, slightly creepy ceramic insects.
Cool. Do you have a website?
I do have a website. It's www.avmeadows.com.
That's A-V-I-E meadows.com.
Yeah.
What are some of the other art mediums that folks can expect to see on the tour that is Saturday, April 20th and Sunday, April 21st?
You can expect every single type of art you can imagine. We have beautiful mosaic stained glass, fiber arts, weaving, 2D, collage, jewelry, mixed media, encaustic, wood turning, everything you can think of.
What about things like film art or audio art, any of that type of art on the tour?
Yeah, we do have a photographer on the tour, and I'm not sure this year about video art, but that's a good suggestion to look for future years.
You can always find more information at the website nost-art.com. And we should mention that proceeds from this event are actually benefiting Vina Moses, a local charity here in Corvallis.
Yeah, we're really excited about that this year, too. Every artist will donate a portion of their sales directly to Vina Moses Center, where emergency assistance is provided to people going through times of hardship. And you can learn more about them. There's a link on our website to Vina Moses, or you can go to the Vina Moses website directly.
And this would seem a great way to build community, as you mentioned earlier, not just opening your home to potential strangers, but sharing your very personal art. Of course, it's made public as it becomes a work of art, but this is a great way to bring the community together and probably spark people's interest in art.
Yeah, you know, oftentimes when we talk about our art, it helps to open the door for conversations that can be vulnerable and life-giving. And so we just find that sharing our art with the community is a great way to have a conversation with people we might not normally ever talk to.
A.V. Meadows is one of the coordinators of the second annual Northside Open Studio Tour. That is an artist-led effort that will encourage the public to explore home studios. This two-day event is going to be Saturday, April 20th, Sunday, April 21st, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and more information is online. I'll let Avi give the website, and then we'll get back to the music.
Yeah, again, that website is www.nost-art.com. Thank you, Dan.
You're listening to KORC. Streaming at korcfm.com.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre with your Corvallis City meetings for the week of March 18th, 2024. On Monday, March 18th, the Corvallis City Council will be holding an executive session at 5 p.m. to discuss the status of pending litigation or litigation likely to be filed. Also on Monday, March 18th, but at 6 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a meeting. The meeting will be held in person at the downtown fire station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. See CorvallisOregon.gov for agenda details and information on how to attend the meeting online. On Tuesday, March 19th at 5 p.m., the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force will be meeting virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting online. On Wednesday, March 20th, the Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Advisory Board will meet virtually at 5 p.m. For details on how to join the meeting, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Thursday, March 21st at 4 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a joint work session with the Budget Commission. The meeting will be held virtually and in person at the downtown fire station, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, a program heard every Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m. and every Monday evening from 5 to 6 p.m. Families of children who will be 5 years old as of September 15, 2024, are eligible and encouraged to enroll their child in kindergarten at their neighborhood school. Enrollment can be completed at the Corvallis School District website. To complete the enrollment process, families will need to provide the following information: proof of address, proof of age, immunization record, educational support documentation. The district has established specific school boundary areas. If you are uncertain about which elementary school is your neighborhood school, you can check any address to see what boundary area it is located in using the school district's district address locator. More information about this is available by calling 541-757-5811. Families enrolling a kindergartner may request a transfer to a school outside their boundary area only after enrolling at their boundary area school. Transfer requests will be accepted online for Corvallis residents from March 18th through April 1st and non-residents from April 15th through the 29th of this year. Transfers will be subject to grade level enrollment and space limitations. There's an upcoming event called Kindergarten Information Night, Monday, March 18th. All K through 5 elementary schools will offer a Kindergarten Information Night, Monday, March 18th, starting at 5:30 p.m., going through 6:15. These information nights are for incoming kindergarten families to visit their neighborhood school. During the school information night, school staff will be on hand to discuss what life as a kindergarten student looks like and answer other questions. For more information about the kindergarten enrollment process in the Corvallis School District, you can contact your Boundary Area School, the Corvallis School District Administration Office at 541-766-4700, or there's more information online at csd509j.net/kindergarten, or you can do a Google search for the Corvallis School District and kindergarten. You're listening to KORC, Community Radio for Corvallis. We're streaming online at korcfm.com, where you can also make a secure online donation. And thank you.